Hey folks, welcome to Bites of Insight. My name is Vinny Secor, and I'm joined with my co-host, Yevgeny Urchov. We're both excited for today's episode. We have John Farley, a cyber leader for Arthur J. Gallagher, joining us. John is a longtime friend and one of the leaders in the cyber insurance industry, has a wealth of knowledge, wealth of experience. We're going to cover AI, also known as artificial intelligence, and we will cover a number of topics related to security, as well as concerns the insurance industry has. I like to affectionately call John one of the OGs in the industry. We might be kind of dating ourselves, but really, we've been together on this since probably when the first policies were written over 20 years ago. Right, John?
Yeah, we are certainly dating ourselves. My history in the industry is 32 years. When I say 32 years, that's insanity. I cannot believe all that time went by. But it's been a long time for sure.
Yeah, well, maybe let's start there. Why don't you just kind of talk to us about what an insurance broker does, and then it'd be kind of fun for everyone to hear how you ended up in cyber, because it's like taking over the world right now. So if you don't mind, share a little bit of your history, that'd be great.
Yeah, sure. So first of all, an insurance broker really is an extension of the risk management team of the client. They have all sorts of risks that they've got to grapple with, and they'll engage a broker to help them first and foremost understand the risks that they're facing. What does it cost if I have a loss based on that risk? How much insurance should I purchase? What kind of insurance policies? And how do I get placed in the best possible light as I get in front of an underwriter who's going to underwrite an insurance policy for me? And so when it comes to cyber, which is my world, we're focused on the data security controls, the cyber threats that are evolving, they're ever evolving, and the policy itself, right? There's no such thing as a standard cyber insurance policy. They've got all different wordings, exclusionary language, perhaps sublimits. And those are the things that the insurance broker has to be well-versed in and be able to sort of translate that all to their client. They've got to go out to the market. They got to negotiate with the insurance companies. They've got to help them with losses when the losses occur, helping the clients figure out how to mitigate the costs and get them back up and running. So you're kind of involved, throughout the entire policy term, whether it's placing the policy, whether it's advocating for claims, helping them understand evolving threats. In cyber, it just never stops evolving, and you really got to be focused on it. And that's why brokers like Gallagher, where I am, we have a dedicated team of cyber insurance specialists, and that's the team I lead.
It's interesting because I think a lot of times people don't quite understand how that works. When you're placing a policy for one of your clients, and one of your clients could be like a Fortune 100 company or a healthcare institution or an SME, a small, medium enterprise, you're actually working with more than one carrier, right? You're working on behalf of your client with a number of different carriers. And, I was thinking about this conversation we were having, and do you typically have a set of policies that you know are a good fit based on the type of client? Like, what's the process there when you get a new client in terms of where you're going to place their policy?
It depends. So certain carriers will have different policies for different size clients. So they usually have a revenue threshold, and they might say, well, if this insured has over $100 million in annual revenue, they can get this policy. Or under that threshold, they get a different policy with different wording. And they may approach it, the insurance carriers may approach it differently with different types of questions. The larger, the more sophisticated the client, the larger revenue, the more questions you're going to have. We've seen cyber insurance applications over 100 questions sometimes. And then we've seen, just a handful. So it really depends on the size, complexity of the organization, the sector that they're in. So in healthcare, you're subject to different regulations around cyber. HIPAA compliance comes into play. Financial services, you have Bramley-Bliley, other regulations there. So there's a lot of really factors that go into it. You have different choices. And again, with cyber, you might have, right now, we probably have well over 100 insurance carriers writing their own cyber insurance policy with their own wording. It's quite a dynamic and complex environment for any insurer who's going to go into it. But if you have a broker who knows the carriers, knows the policies, and knows the threats, I think you're going to be in good shape.
And I think that's the answer to the question, why are we having a conversation with you about artificial intelligence? I think the short answer is because you have to be on top of all the potential risks that are out there, as well as the evolving risks. And, one of my favorite TED Talks I ever watched was by this gentleman named Kevin Kelly. And he said, in this next industrial revolution, everything that we've electrified, we're going to cognify. That kind of leads us to the main topic that we wanted to talk with you about. And which is really artificial intelligence. Yevgeny shared with us the article that you had written on needing a chief AI officer, which we'll get to at a later point, but that was the trigger point. You know, I know you and Yevgeny have done a lot of presentations together on all kinds of cyber threats, but maybe we could just start. I'll start with a question to you and we'll let Yevgeny chime in. Describe to us what the threat landscape is looking at with regards to artificial intelligence. What are the things that you, from a perspective as an insurance broker, you know, helping your clients with cyber coverage, what are you considering as like the main risks and items for consideration with respect to artificial intelligence?
Sure thing. So Vinny, you got to look at it from sort of two different lenses. First and foremost, it is a new tool that hackers are going to leverage to carry out social engineering threats. They're going to try to social engineer victims through phishing emails that are now going to be much more targeted. They're going to use AI to scan social media. They're going to pull your LinkedIn profile. They're going to then launch an email that's going to be spelled perfectly, great grammar, unlike the phishing emails of the past, which you almost knew right away just from the grammar, just from the spelling that they were not real. These were phishing emails. This is going to be much more targeted. They're going to be perfect. And that's something you got to really worry about. You're going to have to train your employees on. But second, and what's really more disturbing on the social engineering aspect is the emergence of deep fake technology. And that's another area that I've focused on where, you know, this is essentially a program that anybody has access to. I've seen how this program works. I've accessed it myself. And basically what it does, it allows you to take existing video and existing audio and manipulate it to make it appear that someone said or did something that they never actually did. And so we've seen this start to come to light in the form of funds transfer claims. One notable case that happened just last year, not even a year ago, I think it was January of this year. It was where we had, somebody received an email what appeared to be phishing. And he said, well, let's set up a video call to make sure this is real. Lo and behold, on the video call is what appears to be the C-suite of this company telling this poor victim, transfer the $25 million. And sure enough, he did. Right? That's what many people would do. We followed the protocol. You know, let's get them on a call. Let's get them on a video call. And sure enough, there's a $25 million loss. So this is not theory anymore. And Evgeny, I'm sure you've heard about that case. I mean, this is really starting to happen.
It's really scary because like on top of the deepfake and technology getting more and more sophisticated, even if you look at it from the law enforcement perspective, let's say you captured some evidence of a voicemail and you're trying to figure out if the bad guy did something or not. And how can you test that the voice that was generated is not authentic? I think with the improvements in the technology, it will be harder and harder to figure it out. And on use cases, how cyber criminals are using it. So phishing emails is definitely like number one that we see being used very, very actively because yes, all the emails with the bad spelling and grammar mistakes, it's thing of all the past, which is unfortunately significantly reduces the barrier of entry for the cyber criminals to join it and do it effectively. But another interesting use case that we also saw was that even though most of the like AI providers claim that, yes, you cannot use it to write malware or Trojans, it's not completely true because, yes, you cannot ask a question, hey, please write me a banking Trojan and get the full code of the application. But at the same time, like if you are struggling with a section of it, you can ask AI, hey, like I'm having some issues with this specific piece of the code. Like, can you fix it? And it's fixable. So like as long as you build it part by part, like AI can assist you significantly to improve malware.
Yeah. You know, when I was prepping for the panel that I did at NetDiligence and I was talking to our threat intel people, Yevgeny, one of the things that, you know, they told me was they said that a lot of times there's people are using AI to like write PowerShell scripts. Is that what you're referring to?
It could be pretty much anything. It could be PowerShell scripts to automate things. It could be like ransomware. Let's talk ransomware. Like a lot of ransomware samples are available on the internet now. So you can theoretically pick one that is widely available and then try to use AI to like improve it, like just focus on specific sections to make it less detectable, more powerful, et cetera.
I remember when ChatGPT came out and the curiosity effect, you know, just being able to ask it a question and having it respond and then ask it a follow-up question and having it respond was pretty addicting. But like every technology, right, there's a use for good and then there's a use for evil. I want to dig down a little bit deeper on the deep fake stuff, specifically because I noticed a trend with the threat actors that there's a lot more calling happening. One of our analysts actually noticed that on some of the dark web boards that there was advertisements for threat actors to almost set up call centers for like nefarious purposes. I mean, what are some ways that people can guard against like that incident, John, you talked about where you had the C-suite on, like knowing that that's out there and knowing that happens, what can our clients do to avoid that from happening to them?
You know, first of all, there are ways to detect deepfakes. First of all, the hair typically stays the same, which is kind of funny. So if you got a bald CEO and suddenly he's got hair, you know it's fake. So I kid, but you actually can detect a deepfake that way. There is some blurring sometimes from the neck, so as they move. So there are some things, but I'll tell you, that may be a good way to detect it now. But as Afghanis said, these things are evolving and these are getting better and better. So I think the detection is going to become more difficult. There may be some other protocols, and maybe you have a live conversation. Sometimes the platforms that they're using are not as intuitive to be able to respond right away. There's got to be a quick response. But again, I'll go back to the technology improving in a year from now. That technique may be defeated. It's a really tough thing.
And I guess from suggestion standpoint, like just don't trust anything. So like if you got a request that looks unusual, like try to find the trusted way to communicate with the person that you just allegedly talked on video chat and double check it.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think about like spontaneous questions on like a video call? Should people ask to see a driver's license or something that's unique? I'm just thinking about the way MFA works, right? Is how do you, in a deep fake situation, introduce another layer?
At this point, it's looking like an in-person meeting to me.
Gosh.
Yeah, then there's the metaverse. We're not going to talk about the metaverse today. That's another problem.
Yeah, we'll save that for a whole nother series because that's a massive topic. Well, hey, I hope it's okay if I bounce around a little bit. Before we started recording, we were having a conversation and you had mentioned this term silent cyber, which for those of us that are kind of tangential to the industry or right in, but aren't as involved as you are, John, maybe it would be helpful if you kind of define what silent cyber is traditionally where we've seen it and then why you're thinking that artificial intelligence kind of like the next area where silent cyber applies.
Yeah, sure thing. So if we go back a few years in the earlier days of cyber, we had a phenomenon called silent cyber exposure. And that really was a situation where if I was a property underwriter or a kidnap and ransom policy underwriter, I wasn't anticipating a cyber attack or the cyber peril, and I might not have excluded it. And what would happen is you'd have a loss, and perhaps the insured didn't have a cyber policy, but they had a kidnap and ransom policy, and there was a ransomware attack where the data was held hostage. They didn't exclude ransom attacks. They were intending to cover executives held captive when they traveled around the globe. They were not anticipating that policy to pay out for data held hostage. But if it wasn't excluded and there was a gray area, oftentimes the insurance carrier had to pay the ransomware attack, right? They had to pay that loss. And so they very quickly started to exclude coverage, and it excluded across property and other lines of coverage that might have had that exposure there. So that was the underwriter's worst nightmare. They never underwrote for it, but now they're paying for it. So we've seen that sort of get more or less cleaned up, although I don't know that we're fully there, but most of the traditional underwriters are excluding it. Now let's move to AI. And let's talk about the potential losses that can occur. So if I'm an organization and I use an AI platform and I use it for hiring practices, right, to scan resumes as they come in, that platform may decide what resumes we're going to look at and what ones we're not going to look at. And it could be inherently biased through no fault of your own, but that platform is excluding a demographic and they're never going to get an interview at my company. You now have an EPL, an employment practices liability claim, where now you're going to look at perhaps your EPO policy and go, yeah, I think I'm covered here. Did that EPO underwriter anticipate, you know, that AI platform discriminating? Did they even know that the insured was using that platform? And by the way, there may not be just one person that's discriminated. It could be thousands of people. So there now, as we move to the AI world, you may have a new silent cyber emerging. And it's not just EPL. You could think about a medical malpractice case where I'm a healthcare organization using AI to give medical advice to patients, and that patient dies, or several patients die because it was off or the algorithm wasn't working the way it should have. And now people drop dead. And now you have a med mal claim coming in. Did the med mal provider exclude coverage? Maybe, maybe not.
So, John, are we saying that the reason why it could be EPL or malpractice is because we're considering the AI to be functioning as an employee of the organization?
That's correct. I mean, the central question is the AI platform an agent of your organization? And I bet if that works its way through the courts, you're going to get the plaintiff's bar arguing that it certainly is. And it's making decisions on your behalf, and you signed off on that, and you're allowing it to do it. The question, you know, may go then to the AI provider. I'm just using the platform that someone else provided. Maybe they're both going to get sued now, the provider and the user. And then it begs the question of, okay, what does the contract say? Does the contract absolve you of liability? Probably not. But take a close look at that, because you're probably both going to get sued in that situation. A regulator may come knocking not only on the AI provider's door, but your door as well. And then it goes, well, okay, what do we do about this? And did we even vet this system? Do we understand what we're doing, you know, by engaging it and adopting it? These are open questions right now, for sure.
So what we're saying here is that the reason why we're considering this to be a silent cyber, potentially it could be like a silent cyber issue, is because the coverage, there just isn't enough coverage out there that is considering some of these things that we're discussing, and the policy's silent on it. Kind of an easy way to describe, you know, what we're talking about is the coverage doesn't mention that example. So we don't know whether it's excluded or it's included. And it's kind of that gray that you mentioned a few minutes ago that is causing some of the concern for the industry. Because, you know, I'll be honest, like, every time I am out there meeting with clients, talking to brokers, talking to underwriters, this is a hot topic. It reminds me of cloud a number of years ago. I remember we used to constantly talk about cloud and how are we going to manage that? And this one, it just almost feels uncontrollable in how fast it's being adopted. It feels like that every industry is adopting it so quickly, and so are consumers. It almost feels like a runaway train at times. Are you feeling that too?
Absolutely. And that's why I've been so focused on it really since it just came out. And remember, this is not even 2 years now that it's out there. We're hearing the whole world talk about it. And at some level, they're adopting it. And right away, I said, we've got to pump the brakes on this. I'm not trying to stop innovation by any means. But at the same time, we've got to understand the risks associated with it. And I published a paper called Key Considerations for Your AI Risk Assessment. And so I looked at it as, okay, if you're going to adopt AI, you've got to do a risk assessment, just like we always did, right, in the past. Really, it goes beyond cyber. You must do sort of a risk assessment. What can go wrong? What am I doing to either mitigate, transfer that risk? Those kind of things. And in that paper, I said, all right, what we've got to do is sit down and try to understand, first and foremost, do we have a system that we're using? Who's using it? Do we have multiple systems? Are they talking to each other, which can heighten risk even further? What purposes are we using it for? And if we're using an outsourced provider to give me the platform, what does the contract say? Am I held harmless, or am I holding that platform harmless? And then you've got regulatory risk. We haven't even talked about that yet. But in the last year alone, we've seen multiple states come up with their own regulation around AI, what you can and can't do. Even the EU has just come out, the EU AI Act, spreading around the globe. So you got regulatory risk. So me is, you know, that extension of the cyber, of the risk management team for a client. That's my role, is to say, wait a minute, here are things that can go wrong. Here's some things that already have gone wrong. What can we learn from them? Can we insure against it? And even if we can't, what can we do to manage the risk? And then I start to think about, you know, data governance and cyber. Well, there's got to be AI governance, sort of a subtitle within your data governance plan. And so there, you have to ask all those questions that I just raised, and you've got to have written policies and procedures in place. It really is an AI governance plan.
I've heard like different approaches to how people kind of want to address it. Some people say, well, it's just another technology, so any of the existing technologies or regulations should apply. But then I've heard the opposite, especially coming from the EU and a lot of the privacy folks. You know, they're asking for transparency. They want to see the algorithms, which is very problematic if you're an AI technology vendor. I'm sure you've seen some of those too. But this definitely does seem like it's at a whole nother level than just a new technology that came out, because it seems like part of the marketing or the ROI for it is it's almost like it's FTE replacement, if I could use that term. FTE is full-time equivalent, that AI is being positioned as this will help reduce the number of employees necessary. This will take on some of the responsibility, which going back to that EPL conversation we had a few minutes ago, it does seem very different because it is replacing, in a sense, some of the decision-making that had been previously been done before. But you know, I want to shift though, because I, you know, one of the challenges we have with cyber is we can tend to focus on the negative because we're always looking at risks. And Yevgeny, maybe I'll just kind of put you on the spot and have you chime in. But like in the world of security, I think like, isn't AI pretty necessary in terms of some of the endpoint detection response technologies, some of the protective technologies? Like, where do you see the AI as being the most beneficial?
Well, it's a definitely very good question. I think the best application of AI specifically in the cybersecurity field is that it potentially can detect patterns that could be potentially missed by like a security operations center specialist. Because you get all the different signals, indicators, et cetera, but you may not see the bigger picture, the bigger pattern. In application like that, I think AI can definitely be very powerful. And to your point, make a lot of detections and process more efficient versus just doing them manually.
Awesome. Okay, John, I have one final question for you. Well, I might be a liar. I might end up asking more after your answer. But, you know, I remember when cloud was coming out, we were pushing really hard to try to update the forms, you know, the application forms, really kind of to do a risk assessment on the aggregate risk of cloud providers. So the thought process was, okay, you know, we have the 10 largest cloud providers. If we get every policyholder to answer the question of, do they use Amazon? Do they use Google? Do they use Rackspace, right? We might be able to get a sense for what the CAT exposure is. And so it's kind of a two-part question because I've noticed the conversations keep mentioning the need for a chief AI officer. And it reminds me of the conversations we used to have back in like 2008, 2009, where we'd say every organization needs to have a chief information security officer, right? It's kind of like, I'd like to think that we had some positive effect on the industry by promoting the need for a CISO. So my two-part question is, one, you know, can you address, we mentioned it briefly earlier on, what you consider like the role of a chief AI officer? And then two, is there a catastrophic risk here that we have to worry about?
First of all, it's funny you mentioned, you know, AI may remove jobs, right? Take over jobs. I think AI is going to create one really important role, and that's the chief artificial intelligence officer. So it's a term I think people are trying to understand. Well, who is this person and what do they do? Really what this role is, and I wrote a paper on it, I recently published it, and it kind of outlines some of the job responsibilities. So this is going to be a person that is going to really work with key stakeholders across multiple divisions of an organization. And they're going to have sort of multiple roles. First, it's going to be innovation, right? Someone's going to have to lead innovation around AI. There's a lot of concern if you don't keep up with AI, you don't engage AI, you're going to fall behind. And so there's this sort of desperate need right now. People are pushing forward. We need to adopt it. And so this person is going to have that as one of their major role. In addition to that, they're going to have to worry about all the things we've been talking about, right? The compliance issues that are swirling around any organization that adopts it. State regulation, federal regulation, and international regulation. The compliance piece of that is going to be huge. And things can go wrong. And so that person is going to also work with the CISO, who's going to have, you know, a data governance plan that's now enhanced to have AI considerations. They'll be working with legal. They'll be working with marketing. They'll be working with sales. They'll be working with operations. This person is going to have sort of a background or at least a deep understanding around data science, but litigation risk, regulatory risk. And so I'm not saying it's going to be easy to find this person, but this person is going to have to embody all that and bring it to the organization and lead innovation. Whereas, you know, the other roles of, say, the CISO, they were just, you know, they're the goalie, right? They're blocking the attacks all day, every day. This person is moving on offense for innovation in addition to dealing with all the other things that are swirling around AI in terms of threats. It's a really interesting role. I think what will probably happen is the largest, most resource-rich companies will find these people somehow, some way, and hire them. But as you go down to sort of the smaller, less sophisticated companies, they'll probably outsource that function in some way, just like many of them still outsource the CISO, right? Or they have a service provider with security. So that's sort of my vision of kind of where this is going right now. We'll see how it plays out. And we'll also see how the losses play out, because losses are going to really drive everything. We have some claims already happening, but the frequency is really not there yet. I think that's going to start because we're all starting to adopt it and we're seeing the regulation already. So the regulatory risk is already there. But really interesting, and I think that's a role that AI has created. It hasn't eliminated for sure.
Do you think the chief AI officer, do you think that's a role that would fall into like the general counsel area, or is it something that's more in like the CIO realm? Like we used to have that debate with CISOs, like should they report to the general counsel or should they report to the CIO? Like, what are your thoughts on that? Yevgeny, I know you kind of shook your head, sounds like you have some thoughts too. So you know, jump in here, please.
I'll let Yevgeny talk, but this person is not going to be in one of those departments. They're going to have a foot in all of them. The ones I mentioned, it's legal. It's the CISO's office. It's in the marketing person's office, you know, and remember, the innovation is kind of what they're leading and all the other threats are sort of also under their wing. So it's kind of interesting where they're going to be kind of everywhere. So Yevgeny, I don't know what your thoughts are.
I think the conversation is very similar to what we had maybe like 10 years ago about the role of CISO and who the CISO is supposed to report to. Like a lot of arguments were that person needs to report directly to CIO versus some other like arrangements. And I think that will be a very similar conversation about the chief AI officer, because to John's point that I completely agree with, that person will be overlapping a lot of different areas like within each organization.
John, thank you so much for your time. Just a couple notes for our audience. You know, John mentioned a couple of articles he's written. We're going to post links to those articles. I think there's an article on a chief AI officer, an article on a risk assessment. I did want to mention something else. We'll try to find and put in the link if it's still available. But, you know, and maybe this will kind of be like our closing, our closing topic is, I'll never forget, like when I was at the NetD, I think it was the one in San Diego, or it might have been the one in Florida. You had actually done a deep fake presentation. It was the only thing people were talking about. I mean, it was literally. I think you scared every single person in the room because I heard about it like nonstop. I think I was on a competing panel, so no one showed up for mine, but they all went to yours. And so I got to hear about it all weekend long. But can you explain what you guys did? Maybe that one was with Hart over at FPOV, Future Point of View. Let's kind of close on that. Tell us the story of that, how you came up with it, and then we'll try to find the link and actually post it so that people can see it.
Yes, it was absolutely a ton of fun, even though it was scary. But the ultimate goal was to educate people around deepfakes. So a good friend of mine, Hart Brown, he's the CEO of Future Point of View, fpov.com, if you want to look up those guys. They are leading the way in helping clients not only engage AI, but also manage risks. And they happen to have the software to create deepfake videos and audios. And so I said, Hart, and Hart's a good friend. I've known him for a long, long time. I said, I'm going to come down to your studio. I'm going to film myself, and I want you to take my film and make me turn into somebody I'm not. And literally, I went down there, filmed in one take, and then he basically took my video and kind of fed it into the program and let the computers run for a couple of days. And they did millions of iterations of me and other people and ultimately decided to, I was going to become Hart and Hart was going to become me because he had video of him and we kind of became each other. And I said, Hart, wouldn't it be a great idea to go to NetDiligence, stand on stage in front of everybody, and then have a big screen behind us and watch the deepfake play out where I'm talking and then suddenly I become him and he becomes me. And we did just that. And it was absolutely wild. I couldn't believe it. And it was so easy to create that the machines did it for us. You know, we just needed the videos and feed it in. And you could become anybody you want. I mean, there are celebrities you can impersonate if you want. Granted, I would recommend to talk to your legal team before you do that because you got to get permission of celebrities to share with NetDiligence. So we did not do that, but you could. And it's just incredible. All you need are just a little bit of video, a little bit of audio. And so we showed the whole audience at NetDiligence exactly how that happened. And as they saw us on stage and saw it happen on a big screen behind us, it really hit home. And they said, wow, this can happen. Anybody can do this. If I did it, you can do it. So that's how we did it. And I think we'll have to sort of think about the next NetD and figure out the next conference of what we do. But we think we want to kind of build on that for sure.
I guess kind of the point to leave everybody with is, you know, John, you're a brilliant guy, but you're not a technology guy. And neither is heart. So the two of you were able to do this, use this technology. So it kind of explains how powerful the technology is that you guys came up with an idea and then you did it. And you did it for fun and you did it to educate the industry. But oh my gosh, what others can do with this technology is crazy.
It is. It's scary. It's not just about funds transfer and insurable things. You think about geopolitical conflict. You think about so many things that can go wrong when you impersonate somebody. It's absolutely frightening. I mean, we joke, you know, because we kind of kept it light, but you really have to take it seriously because it is something that really can sway elections and can lead to wars and conflicts. And we just, you know, we got to start thinking about that and managing that.
You know, we're all dads on this podcast. Like, it's terrifying for kids. It's like, I've heard of a couple incidents at schools where the school boards have had to get involved because of deepfake technology being used nefariously, you know, by students and things. And so the fact that it's as easy as it is to be used, that leads, you know, to why it's so terrifying.
The laws haven't caught up yet. I mean, we're trying to regulate this now and we're scrambling to do so. But, you know, right now, anybody can get that technology and create a deepfake. As you said, this can affect everybody. This isn't just political leaders. This is your daughter or your son. It's absolutely terrifying, as you said.
Any final thoughts before we sign off?
No, I just think, you know, with emerging technology, whether it's AI, deepfake, whatever it is, I mean, we've got to think about, before embracing it, understanding what can go wrong when you do. So that's just me. That's my nature. That's the role I play in life. And so, yeah, move forward with technology, but be wary about the things that can go wrong and manage that risk.
Well, thank you so much for your time. John, it's always fun to talk to you. It's always fun to see you. It's always great when the two of you and Yevgeny are together. I love watching your presentations and things. So it's kind of fun to get the band back together, so to speak.
All right. Thanks, Vinny. Thanks, Yevgeny.
Bye, guys.
Thank you for joining us on Bites of Insight with Vinny Secor and Yevgeny Urchov. If you found today's episode valuable, hit follow on Spotify to catch new episodes packed with expert insights and actionable advice. Alongside Bites of Insight, this channel also features our monthly Cyber Campfire, where our threat intel team dives into emerging and ongoing trends. For more on Arete Solutions and our mission to create a world free from cyber extortion, visit us at areteir.com. If you'd like to connect or have questions, reach out to our team at marketing@areteir.com. And for immediate support with an active cyber incident, please contact us at arete911@areteir.com. Until next time, stay safe and stay secure.